waiting, being resigned to only 10 to 15 minutes with the doctor, and getting treatment based on a snapshot of the situation. There is an alternative. You can accept the role of the healing self. Consider the qualities of an ideal doctor, which would include the following: patience, sympathy, an open mind, vigilance over changes in the patient's condition, close monitoring, detailed knowledge of the patient's history, thorough medical knowledge and expertise. Only the last item on the list is exclusive to the medical profession. Everything else is something you can provide yourself, either through self-care or in conjunction with a good doctor. Certain things like constant monitoring are available only to you or by being admitted to the hospital. Most of what's on the list are things you are probably doing already, even though you aren't aware of acting as a healer. Maximizing them will be very important, because awareness needs to be an everyday habit, even a skill. By the same token, the bad qualities we'd hate to see in a doctor are often present in how we treat ourselves from day to day. Millions of people approach their health with one or more of the following: indifference, denial that pain and other symptoms need attention, worry and anxiety, lack of information, guesswork, undertaking needless or ineffective treatments. Clearly, these are things that everyone wants to avoid, but we fall into self-defeating responses all the time. We worry needlessly or pretend that nothing hurts. We guess at what's wrong and then reach impulsively for something we hope will work. Usually this means grabbing a bottle from the medicine cabinet or kitchen cupboard. Most of the time, the impulse is temporary, so we go back to waiting and worrying. You are in a position, starting now, to adopt the role of self-healer. By going deeper into the power of awareness, you can activate the hidden potential of the healing system that you already depend upon every day. We hope this all sounds exciting, because some major life changes lie ahead. But first, we need to make very clear what this book is not about. A realistic baseline. We won't show you how to overcome a chronic illness like arthritis, type 1 diabetes, or congestive heart failure. We don't have cures for incurable diseases like Alzheimer's. We aren't promising a cure for cancer. Nothing we advise lies outside proven medical practice. We aren't talking about faith healing, placebos, or magical thinking. Once you have developed symptoms or a full-blown disorder, you must seek qualified medical care. Where are you now? Some will be disappointed that this book isn't about curing a full-blown illness on your own. But the advantages of the healing self are immense, because you learn how to consciously remain in a state of well-being that increases for your entire life. As big as this concept is, healing comes down to personal experience today, tomorrow, and the day after. To that end, we are asking you to pause and take two quizzes. The first quiz will assess where you are now, in other words, your starting point for your healing journey. The second quiz will assess how great your potential is, how far healing can take you. Quiz number one. Where are you today? For each question, consider your experience in the past month. Mark each item according to how often an experience has occurred, as follows. 1 equals not at all or once at most. 2 equals sometimes. 3 equals fairly often. 4 equals often. I was depressed. I felt worried and anxious. I had to go to the doctor's office. I was in pain, but didn't go to the doctor's office. A chronic health problem was present. I ate the wrong foods, fast food or junk food. I was under pressure. I felt stressed out. I had trouble getting to sleep. I didn't get enough sleep. I didn't control my weight. I had a headache. I had a backache. My relationships didn't go well. I got seriously angry. I neglected exercise and physical activity. I had self-doubt or self-esteem issues. I felt lonely. I felt unloved or uncared for. There were troubling family issues. I was worried about the future. Assessing your answers. This quiz doesn't lead to a total score. Each individual answer is what we will focus on. If you have lots of 3 or 4 responses, your life over the last month has been a struggle. Most people, however, will have some 3 or 4 answers, no matter how well their lives are going. Hold on to your results and take the quiz again after you finish reading this book. Take it every few days or weekly after you adopt a healing lifestyle. If your answers improve, you have proof and motivation that such a lifestyle really works. Quiz number 2. Your highest positive experiences. Healing is a holistic process, and the healing self opens the way for higher experiences that make life more joyous and meaningful. We want to know how many higher experiences you are having now. For each question, consider your experience in the past month. Mark each item according to how often an experience has occurred, as follows. 1 equals not at all or once at most. 2 equals sometimes. 3 equals fairly often. 4 equals often. I felt contented inside. I expressed love openly to someone else. I felt free and liberated. I saw myself without blame or judgment. I was appreciated and praised by someone at work or in my family. I felt inner peace and tranquility. I felt myself to be part of a larger plan or vision. I experienced a loving gesture toward me. I had a spiritual experience. I felt loving kindness and compassion. I forgave someone. I forgave myself. I let go of something negative from the past. I developed an emotional bond with someone. I felt blessed. I sensed what I'd call a divine or holy presence. I was lighthearted. My faith in human goodness was affirmed. I felt blissful or ecstatic. I saw or experienced inner light. I experienced pure being or unbounded awareness. I saw the sacredness of another person. I meditated, prayed, or did another contemplative practice. I felt creatively inspired. Assessing your answers. As before, this quiz doesn't lead to a total score. Each individual answer is what we will focus on. If you have lots of one or two responses, your life over the last month has probably felt mundane and uninspired. Most people, however, will have some one or two answers, no matter how fulfilled their lives are. Access to higher experiences is still waiting. As with the first quiz, hold on to your results and take the quiz again after you finish reading this book. Every few days or weekly after you adopt our suggestions for a healing lifestyle, look at your answers again. If they improve, you have proof and added motivation that higher experiences aren't rare or random. They're accessible through your healing self anytime you want. Now, you have a better idea of what getting real about your health actually entails. You've discovered the concepts that are critical for moving away from the gambling model for staying healthy. Realizing that consciousness is the key now places you on the threshold of transformation. There are many details to explain, and the following chapters describe the nitty-gritty of our new model. Yet nothing is as important as knowing that the healing self is real. It's as close to you as the next breath and as vital as the next heartbeat. 2. Who stays well and who doesn't? The beauty of a whole system approach is its naturalness. All the most basic things we do to stay alive affect the whole system. We breathe, we eat, we go to sleep. Advanced medical science delves into these processes extensively, and the deeper the research goes, the more complex eating, breathing, and sleep turn out to be. But this shouldn't cloud a simple fact. The people who manage to stay well their entire lives and who enjoy the highest state of wellness are people who have no trouble getting 8 hours of good sleep a night, who eat a balanced, nourishing diet that maintains a healthy weight, and who breathe easily. That is, they are not burdened by stress and anxiety. Millions of us cannot say that we've mastered the most basic whole system processes. Somehow, the naturalness of staying well has escaped us. How can this be? By analogy, think about a self-driving car. Long dreamed of by engineers, such a car has now become feasible, and its advent has been greeted with both optimism and panic. To the optimists, the self-driving car will be a boon to safety, equipped with artificial intelligence and sensors that maintain a constant state of vigilance in 360 degrees. A driverless car would be able to detect potential dangers on the road almost instantly, far quicker than even the best human driver. But what if these safety mechanisms fail? That's where the panic comes in. Being driven into an accident by a machine you aren't controlling feels like a nightmare. In practice, therefore, a self-driving car needs to include a means for the human driver to intervene and take control. Judgment calls always occur in traffic situations. Not many of us, at this stage at least, would be willing to relinquish all control to a machine. Possibly we never will, given the risks to life and limb. Much the same predicament relates to our bodies. Although perfectly self-regulating in its machinery, a simplistic term but useful in this case, the body is under dual control. At the outset of this book, we mentioned the example of breathing. Whether you pay attention or not, you breathe in and out automatically. It's a basic survival mechanism. But any time you want, you can intervene and breathe a different way, faster or slower, deeper or shallower. Because the body operates as a whole system, Your interventions aren't local. A different style of breathing could be linked to a panic attack at one extreme and a mindful yoga practice at the other. Which means that every intervention has the possibility of moving you away from your natural state of wellness. Apparently, millions of people have done just that. The signs are obvious in dozens of ways. Poor sleep, chronic lifestyle diseases, obesity, anxiety, and depression head the list. The healing response is compromised by a huge disruption like pneumonia or polio. But these devastating events are becoming rarer and more curable. The real threat to healing comes from the daily interventions we make that have negative or unforeseen consequences. These are the raindrops that can eventually cause a flood. The healing response holds no judgments. It adapts to every choice you make, positive or negative. Your cells are chemical factories that alter their production line depending on the input you give them, which acts like a directive from upper management. Because everyone's life is a mixture of good and bad choices, everything in life must be viewed as either raising your state of wellness or lowering it. Our cells, all the way down to the genetic level, tolerate our indulgences, but are paying the price for them as well. The solution is to use the body's dual control as a tool of healing. In the most basic terms, there are two kinds of healing going on in every person right now. Automatic healing, which everyone inherited in their genes through millions of years of evolution. Conscious healing, which covers every opportunity to assist and improve automatic healing. Any experience is a possible candidate for healing. The simple fact is that a day without any sensation of physical pain doesn't escape the following experiences: feeling depressed, helpless, or hopeless, worrying about the future, feeling anxious, fearful, or unsafe, being stuck in old behaviors and bad habits, low self-esteem, lack of fulfillment, troubled relationships, feeling lonely, shut out, and unappreciated, leading a life without much purpose or meaning, guilt and shame from old traumas and wounding. Who can say that something on this list isn't afflicting them right now or didn't occur in the past? According to a recent survey, 1 in 6 American adults is reported to be taking psychiatric drugs. Relieving symptoms, as we saw, doesn't get at the real cause of a disorder like depression. Research has attacked the cause of depression through brain scans to see if a specific area of the brain is involved. Through genetic profiling, to discover if there is a unique depression gene or group of genes, and through psychiatric evaluation, hoping that a pattern of behavior leads to the onset of depression. Yet, no specific cause has been found along any of these paths. The most accepted conclusion, in fact, is that each person's depression is unique, exhibiting an array of psychological, physiological, and genetic traits. Depression is linked to personal experience and how you react to it. Reading about bad news in the paper doesn't automatically trigger the same reaction in different people, who can respond with a huge range of reactions from indifference to deep depression. The same variability applies to anxiety, which is why one person collects spiders as an enjoyable hobby and another person is deathly afraid of them. Are you in a troubled relationship? Does your life seem to lack purpose and meaning? It's not the fault of medical treatment that such a huge range of perceptions is untreatable. These causes of suffering have no drug cure. They don't even fit the standard medical model of disease, which stubbornly insists on physical changes as the real cause of illness. As a counter to this bias, impressive studies have shown that invisible subjective states can have a powerful effect on the body. For example, researchers at the University of Texas Medical School looked at mortality rates among a group of men and women who had received open-heart surgery, including heart bypass and replacement of the aortic valve. If you take the routine medical approach, the reason someone dies 6 months after open-heart surgery, while someone else doesn't, must come down to a physical difference. But the team headed by Dr. Thomas Oxman took an unorthodox approach. They asked these patients two questions about their social situation. Do you participate regularly in organized social groups? Do you draw strength and comfort from your religion or spiritual faith? These are simple yes or no questions, and when assessing the answers, the researchers excluded the typical risk factors for dying after heart surgery, including age, severity of the disease, and severity of a previous heart attack. With these factors zeroed out, the findings were startling. A person who answered yes to both questions had less than a 5% chance of being dead 6 months after their surgery. A person who answered no to both questions had between a 20% and 25% chance of being dead 6 months after the surgery. Overall, being socially supported and taking comfort from your faith makes you 7 times more likely to survive major heart surgery than someone who has neither of those things in their life. This outcome is almost certainly the only 7-fold difference in any risk for heart mortality. Even bad cholesterol levels, high blood pressure, and a genetic history of heart attacks in the family. While asking somebody if they belong to a social group like a club or church is an objective measure, the question about religious or spiritual faith is entirely about how the person feels. How you feel is entirely subjective, but just as important, it's an activity in consciousness. A small indicator of your self-awareness, the support for conscious healing couldn't be more obvious. Marge's story. Awareness comes first. Much of the healing response remains a mystery. No one really knows or can predict in all cases why one person gets sick and another doesn't. The hidden reasons exist in a shadow zone beyond the physical. Some people provide living proof that consciousness-based healing, as a way of life, works. Consider an elderly woman named Marge, who proudly remained active and self-sufficient until she was 91. Marge still lived alone in her apartment, cooked for herself, continued to drive her car, and hired a house cleaner only for heavier chores. Marge's health was unusually good, in that compared with an average of 7 prescription drugs taken by seniors over age 70, she was on just 1 medication for high blood pressure. In an aging population, more people will be eager to know Marge's secret. Is it good genes for longevity? To date, no definitive research has clearly found such a gene or group of genes, although there are strong clues, as you'll see a bit later. Typically, if your parents both survive to 80, your lifespan is expected to be 3 years longer than average, not a great advantage. As a statistic, Marge did have certain advantages. She was born into a well-to-do family in Cincinnati, which meant that she had good medical care, not that this would have saved anyone from serious childhood illness in 1920 when she was born. Antibiotics, for example, still lay in the future. She was lucky not to contract tuberculosis, polio, or scarlet fever. An absence of serious childhood diseases is associated with longer life. But in her mind, none of these factors was the deciding one. "I had a difficult marriage to an artist in New York," she recalls. "We were both strong-willed, and we fought a lot. Most of my energy was spent on him rather than on my three sons. I'm not proud of that. And as much as I loved my boys, I could be harsh with them. Looking back, Marge realizes now that it took decades for just one psychological trait, her anger, to have drastic effects on her life. I divorced when my boys were barely teenagers. One went off to boarding school and the other two chose to live with their father, who was so angry with me in general that he fought to keep all our money for himself and his sons. Suddenly I was completely alone and bewildered over how my life could be overturned so drastically. Marge fought with depression. It became obvious that her sons had been scarred by her hot temper growing up. I forgot what made me so mad the minute things calmed down, but they didn't. They actually became afraid of me, their mother. Up to this point in her story, nothing would suggest that Marge would live longer than average. Perhaps the reverse, if her depression had become chronic and affected her health status. Then, a single factor changed her life. Marge became a Buddhist. To her, this decision created an inner transformation. "I found a Zen master through a friend," she recalls. "I can't even tell you why I gave Buddhism a try, but once I started to meditate, two things happened. First, by becoming calmer, my bad temper wasn't triggered by every little thing. Second, I saw something real about myself. Deep down, I was very anxious about being alone. All the drama I kicked up was a tactic to get people to pay attention to me, and that defended me from how alone I really felt." Today at 96, Marge lives in a retirement home at the lowest level of their assisted living program, which means that somebody looks in on her several times a day and helps her bathe. Her medications haven't increased. She goes down to lunch and dinner on her own and takes excursions with friends to eat out once a week. Two things only are areas of difficulty. My hip replacement, which I got in my 70s, has begun to wear out, so I've decided to use a wheelchair rather than walk a long distance. And my sons are still wary of me. Having an angry mother isn't something they have been able to overcome easily. That's the only sorrow that lingers in my mind. Otherwise, I'm at peace. Marge was fortunate to begin meditating so long ago, because the late 1970s was really the first time mainstream medicine began to produce studies showing that meditation was associated with positive health outcomes such as lower blood pressure. Relaxation was the recognized tag word for other benefits, such as reduced stress and anxiety. Skip ahead 40 years, and meditation became more popular and accepted. Today, the whole system approach dissolves all the artificial barriers between mind and body. The realization that every experience has a mental result and a physical result is gathering greater force every day. Take a simple fact that grief lowers a person's immune response. Grief is a drastic mental event, a source of psychological pain. When someone is still seriously grief-stricken 6 months after a death in the family, which occurs in about 10% of bereavements, their condition is known as traumatic grief. Studies on those who suffer from traumatic grief indicate global impairment is very likely, meaning, in layman's terms, that almost anything can go wrong with their health. A study of 150 widows and widowers, for example, found that the presence of traumatic grief symptoms approximately 6 months after the death of the spouse predicted such negative health outcomes as cancer, heart trouble, high blood pressure, suicidal thoughts, and changes in eating habits at 13 or 25-month follow-up. Rudy remembers that after his father died at the age of 45, when Rudy was 17, it took years for his mother to overcome her grief and live a normal life again. If you absorb what this all means, certain people, for unknown reasons, are hit harder by grief than others. The natural recovery time for grief doesn't heal them, and up to 2 years later, they are at risk for all kinds of disorders, both mental and physical. Other studies have found similar results relating to disturbed sleep, low self-esteem, and sad mood. Traumatic grief throws into high gear the power of the mind-body connection. Although medical science can tell us many things on the physical side about cancer and heart disease, and going deeper can even spot the chemical imbalances that might show up in someone who suffers from traumatic grief, there is no cause that triggers this kind of long-lasting grief, no knowledge about why the healing system failed, and little understanding about the purpose and meaning of grief in the first place. Other mammals do not appear to grieve, with suspected exceptions like elephants and domesticated dogs. If a deer is shot by a hunter in a herd of deer, the rest of the herd is disturbed briefly before going back to normal grazing. The emphasized words in the last paragraph, cause, why, purpose, meaning, point to an undeniable fact. Humans live for a purpose, and when the purpose is damaged, your beloved spouse dies, grief can make life seem meaningless. Every cell in the body gets the message in chemical form. The chemicals are the physical evidence of grief, but the loss of meaning isn't chemical. It's human in the larger sense. As painful as grief is, if someone felt no grief at the loss of a spouse, that would be considered strange. Some might say behind their backs that they are heartless, another very human word. Invisible healing. The healing self is the part of us that deals with invisible causes. The why of who gets sick and who doesn't, and the purpose and meaning of being alive. Healing isn't mystical just because it's invisible. Someone who has never thought about the healing response will, in all likelihood, want to be happy, and one key to overall happiness is feeling loved. Is it really possible that your cells can feel loved too? Before reacting to what seems like a ridiculous assertion, consider the following study. Yale researchers looked at 119 men and 40 women who received the most accurate test for detecting blockages in the coronary arteries, known as coronary angiography. It's an anxiety-provoking procedure for many people, although relatively non-invasive. Typically, a narrow catheter inserted in the forearm is threaded into the arteries of the heart. A dye is injected that will show up the interior of the artery using a CT or MRI scan. In this way, the size of the vessel's opening or blockage can be seen directly. Patients who told the researchers that they felt loved and emotionally supported generally exhibited less blockage in their coronary arteries, the main cause of heart attacks and strokes. There are other risk factors that predict the presence of heart disease, such as diet, exercise, smoking, and family history. But even when these were taken out of the equation, the feeling of being loved and emotionally supported was a predictor of who would have more or less arterial blockage. A study of 131 women in Sweden came to the same conclusion. But perhaps the most striking research was based on asking a single question. A team at Case Western Reserve University surveyed 10,000 married men with no history of angina pectoris, the typical chest pain associated with heart disease, although heart attacks can occur without this previous symptom. As expected, the men who scored highest on the familiar risk factors for heart disease, such as high cholesterol, hypertension, and older age were more than 20 times more likely to develop angina over the next 5 years. Then the researchers asked a simple question. Does your wife show you her love? The men who answered yes were less likely to develop angina even when they had high scores on known risk factors. The reverse was also true. A man with high risk factors who said his wife didn't show him her love was almost twice as likely to develop angina. As with traumatic grief, taking the mind-body connection seriously is enough to explode two of the most common assumptions driving medical care. 1. Healing is physical and happens automatically. 2. When the automatic healing response breaks down, the only thing a doctor can do is to intervene with drugs or surgery. From opposite extremes of the emotional spectrum, love and grief cross the boundary between mental and physical. Heart disease is treatable with drugs and surgery, but these can prove ineffective in someone who feels isolated, lonely, or unloved. The unpredictable physical effects of traumatic grief aren't treatable by drugs and surgery. After all, you can't give a pill for everything that might go wrong 13 to 25 months from the onset of grief. By ignoring the healing self, a physician in everyday practice has left out a key part of health and healing. Basic awareness. Taking everything we've said so far, the benefits of conscious healing are there for the asking. But for many people, conscious simply means that you aren't asleep or knocked out. They have the same potential to be aware as the most advanced yogi or monk, but no one taught them how to use this ability. Take three people and sit them in the same room, then ask them what they are aware of. You'll receive random answers that won't necessarily overlap. One person is aware of a smell in the room, another of the wallpaper, the height of the ceiling, and so on, depending on what is being noticed at the moment. Less likely is that one of them will be aware of an inner state, thoughts, moods, sensations. Only if you blatantly change the environment, like turning up the temperature to 85 degrees, will everyone be likely to mention the same thing. Spiritual practices in yoga and other Eastern traditions are actually about honing random awareness to make it sharper, turning an innate ability into a skill. Before they are aware of anything out there or in here, those who have trained their awareness will universally say that they are self-aware. The average person is also self-aware. You can't have a sense of I without it. But self-awareness is only one piece of the swirling, random, unpredictable activity going on in the mind. Awareness skills don't have to be associated with spirituality or the East. They can be used to improve your quality of life. That's where the healing self becomes practical in any situation, at any moment of the day, and with any religious background. It monitors the signals that indicate your immediate state of well-being, here and now. These levels include the following. Knowing how you feel physically. This involves being open and sensitive to the signals your body is sending you. Knowing how to interpret these signals. This involves acceptance of your body as your greatest ally, not a source of distress. Knowing what is happening inside you emotionally. This involves giving up on denial, wishful thinking, fear, and repressing your emotions. When someone casually asks, "How are you?" we usually give an equally casual answer, but the healing self takes the question seriously. By knowing what is actually going on, you are beginning the process of self-healing. A wearable device can buzz you when your heart rate jumps, your blood pressure rises, or your breathing becomes erratic. These are useful indicators, certainly. But only you can respond to the signals and begin the healing. As a practical example of basic awareness, here's what you can do almost effortlessly at work. Mindful at work, 7 self-aware things you can do right now. Adopt any or all of the following tips to counter the invisible negative influences that afflict the typical workplace. 1. In Eastern traditions, awareness should be one-pointed, which means that you keep your attention in a state of relaxed focus. Don't multitask, which divides your attention and has been proved to reduce efficiency at work. 2. To keep your focus relaxed instead of tense, do what you can to work in an area that's quiet and relatively free of interruptions, so that your coworkers won't feel that you are unavailable. Take time twice an hour to circulate, be in contact, and let it be known that you want personal interactions. In this way, your alone time is likely to be more respected. 3. Awareness should be in the now. To stay in the present moment, don't let small demands pile up. Immediately take care of anything that takes 5 minutes or less. If you make this a habit, your time management will improve, sometimes dramatically, and you won't get to the end of the day complaining that you didn't have enough time to do everything you needed to do. 4. Be mindful of your body and its needs. At a minimum, get up out of your chair, stretch, and move around at least once an hour. 5. Be mindful of your core or center. When you feel frazzled, find a quiet place where you can close your eyes, take some deep breaths, and become centered again. Some people find that centering works better if they put their attention in the region of the heart. 6. Remember to breathe, because breath connects many body functions, including heart rate, blood pressure, and the stress response. At least once an hour, do a few 10-count breaths as follows. Breathe in to a count of 4. Hold for a second as you relax into the feeling of the in-breath. Then breathe out to a count of 6. Make sure your pace feels comfortable, not so slow that you gasp after a few breaths. Typically, your breathing rate will slow down from 14 breaths per minute to 8, with an accompanying feeling of calmer mind. 7. Be mindful of your ultimate purpose, which isn't to meet a deadline, but to create a day with happiness in it. Psychologists have found that people who lead the happiest lives follow a strategy of having happy days. Whatever makes you genuinely smile counts as a happy experience. These same practices are also effective outside the workplace. Yet we typically spend over 1/3 of every weekday at work, and sometimes far more. The average white-collar worker who brings work home is estimated to spend 60 hours or more per week. It can be a challenge to remain self-aware under workplace pressures and demands, but the benefits are considerable. If you can stay centered and focused without being frazzled by the mental noisiness that crowds into a typical workday, you will be genuinely meditating in the midst of action, one of the primary goals in every wisdom tradition. Leaving spiritual issues aside, being self-aware is a major component of a healing lifestyle. 3. Nothing is better than love. The research showing that people who feel loved are more likely to enjoy healthier hearts than those who feel unloved is important. It puts real science behind something we all know personally. Love is the healthiest of all emotions, It sustains life at a level of trust, joy, and compassion unrivaled by anything else. A great poet from India, Rabindranath Tagore, declared that love was no mere emotion but a cosmic force. To be raised in a loveless household is the cruelest fate a child can endure, as the following story poignantly illustrates. Patrick, now in his early 30s, didn't believe that he had suffered emotional damage as a child. He only knew that when his mother said she loved him, he couldn't expect her to hug him or even touch him. Her distance was a constant from an early age. "I was hospitalized when I was 5 to get my tonsils taken out," Patrick recalls. "It was Valentine's Day, and I was in a ward with other kids. Their mothers came by with cards and candy, but my mother didn't. But that's the funny thing. What I remember is turning my face to the wall and holding a pillow over my ears so I couldn't hear the other kids and their moms. I carried a grudge around for years, and then a peculiar thing happened. One day, my mom and I were having lunch, and my curiosity got the best of me. I asked her why she never came to see me in the hospital, and you know what she said? She told me she arrived a bit late when visiting hours started, and she found me curled up in the bed crying. She comforted me, she said, but that part I don't remember, only the feeling of being alone and forgotten. Young children, as many psychologists attest, form powerful beliefs about their upbringing that don't always match the facts. It has taken medical science a long time to stop believing that only facts, as measured by medical tests and diagnoses, are the sole component of being healthy. Beliefs matter. Even when those beliefs are totally subjective, we all believe the stories we tell ourselves. This story begins with the messages our parents send in childhood. Patrick's parents sent a message that told him he was on his own. Being aloof and unaffectionate themselves, they treated this as normal. But children need to feel closely connected to a parent who is loving and protective. This is an evolutionary trait millions of years old. In a famous experiment, baby monkeys were separated from their mothers and soon became restless, anxious, and insecure in their behavior. When given an artificial mother constructed out of wire mesh with padding around the torso, the babies immediately attached themselves to it, clinging for comfort. In humans, the effects of poor bonding are just as devastating. Even though we have superior abilities to adapt even to the worst conditions, in Patrick's case, believing that he was on his own led to what is known psychologically as loose attachment. In layman's terms, he didn't feel safe, valued, and protected. In his mind, true or not, if he was in trouble, no one would be there for him. That's an exaggerated black-and-white notion. No doubt his parents would have been shocked to hear it, but kids' ideas tend to be like this, based on indelible emotional experience. "I was lucky in a way," Patrick recalls with a faint smile. "I got very good at being independent. Everyone commented on how I was like a little adult, even when I was 7 or 8. I was proud of it. I became a super achiever because that's what adults do. And this went on for a long time." When he started dating in his teens, Patrick didn't fill the hole in his heart. He had no idea how to. Getting close to someone felt alien, in fact. Keeping true to his story that he had to look out for himself, he was motivated mainly by his growing sexual urges. Girls tended to go along with this, and if they started to want more and the relationship verged on getting serious, Patrick found excuses to start a fight or act so cold that the girl, bewildered and hurt, walked away. By the time he got to college, studying computer science, Patrick's isolation, emotionally speaking, was baked in. His ability to take care of himself was unquestioned. What he didn't realize was this. He took care of himself because he believed that nobody else would. He had no model for a nurturing, protecting love. The story could have stopped there. Fortunately for him, it didn't. In graduate school, he met a girl, and she was different. Patrick's totally rational worldview collided with love at first sight. "To be honest," he says, "I thought those words were just clichés. The first time I met Fran, I saw her for only a second outside the department while she was talking to some friends, but I was riveted. There was just something about her. I got up my nerve and introduced myself. She was friendly and smiled. Nothing else happened, but I went home, and Fran was all I could think about. She agreed to go out with me, and things just unfolded from there. Without warning, I had become a fool in love. I died inside if she had a change of plans and couldn't see me. I kicked myself every day to make sure it was true. I'd fallen in love with the most beautiful woman in the world." Despite the undoubted experience of falling in love at first sight, and abundant evidence that love creates powerful physiological changes, the whole phenomenon remains mysterious. Do chemical changes in neural activity mean that Patrick's brain fell in love? Or did he? In a whole system approach, the two are inseparable. Where healing is concerned, there are some deep issues that cross the mind-body boundary. How and why does love promote physical health? When infatuation turns into lasting love, what can this do for our well-being? If love becomes deep enough, does it open the door for higher consciousness? The human experience testifies that love has a unique power in all these areas. And if we investigate deeply enough, there are answers for why this is so. Love reaches deep and far. We live in an age in which such an overwhelming experience, one that transforms someone's entire being, is explained as biochemistry. But even with sophisticated brain scans and measurements of hormone levels and the like, what's missing is the meaning of falling in love. That meaning is all-embracing. In the terms we're using, love is a whole system event. The studies that indicate how coronary arteries respond to love, or the lack of it, are only the tip of the iceberg. We carry a deep evolutionary imprint at a genetic level. To quote psychologist Barbara Fredrickson, "Somewhere in our brains, we carry a map of our relationships. It is our mother's lap, our best friend's holding hand, our lover's embrace. All these we carry within ourselves when we are alone. Just knowing that these are there to hold us if we fall gives us a sense of peace." What's most significant is that even when someone is alone, sitting quietly and passively, they aren't really alone. Inside, they carry a map constructed from all the relationships experienced since infancy. This, too, is a whole system phenomenon. Each moment in a relationship is a tiny piece being fitted into the whole map as it changes and shifts. To see how this works, give the first answer that comes to your mind when you read the following statements. "My mother loved me enough. Yes, no. I'm glad I had the father I had. Yes, no. I trust where I am right now. Yes, no. My current relationship is in a very good place. Yes, no. I have a good friend I'm closely bonded with. Yes, no. I like being emotional. Yes, no. I tend to show how I feel. Yes. No. Others feel safe confiding in me. Yes. No. I am a nurturer. Yes. No. I feel as if I belong. Yes. No. There are no right or wrong responses to these statements, but if you answer quickly without pausing to give what you believe is the right answer, your responses come directly from your inner map of love and relationship. You may be happy or shocked by your responses, and we will be showing you how to improve your inner map in many ways. Here, just be aware of how an inner image you probably never think about is affecting you, not incidentally, but as the story of who you are, involving the whole person. A whole system approach would predict that love, or the lack of it, would have multiple effects, and it does. In terms of biochemistry, a number of significant changes take place when someone falls in love. Levels of brain neurochemicals such as dopamine and serotonin go up, together with hormones like cortisol and follicle-stimulating hormone. These are the earliest changes of falling in love. Ironically, the last two are indicative of stress caused by the arousal between the sexes. In other words, there's a chemical basis for why romantic love brings joy and pain. Shakespeare intuited a fact of neuroscience in A Midsummer Night's Dream with the famous line, "The course of true love never did run smooth." Even more intriguing is that testosterone levels go down in men and up in women as we age, leading to change in temperament that render two members of the opposite sex just a bit more alike. Even more far-reaching are the possible effects of love on the healing response. How well your immune system works is a crucial factor, and it is well documented that emotions change the immune system. Doctors Janice Kecolt Glaser and Ronald Glaser looked at couples who had been married for a long time, on average 42 years, and found that those who constantly argued had a decreased immune response. If this finding seems to be a sad comment on older marriages, the same effect occurs very quickly, too. A study of couples who were on their honeymoon showed that newlyweds who showed hostile and negative behavior when asked to discuss the topic of marital troubles had a decreased immune response. By now, having read this far, you won't be surprised that the body responds to positive and negative emotions. But the speed of this response may still surprise you. A pioneering study by psychologist David McClelland and his team at Harvard asked students to watch a film on the work being done in the slums of Calcutta by Mother Teresa, the Catholic nun who gained worldwide fame by caring for the poorest abandoned children. As a control, a second group of students watched a neutral documentary on another subject. On average, the students who watched the Mother Teresa film showed increased levels of antibodies on the spot, along with decreased measures of stress like reduced blood pressure. This finding is impressive for showing how the body responds here and now to emotional experiences. But McClelland wondered why some of these students actually had a decreased immune response to watching Mother Teresa's good works. As a follow-up, all of the original study group were shown a photo of a couple sitting on a bench by a river. When asked to write a story about the couple, some students described them as loving, supportive, and respectful, while others wrote very different stories in which the couple was unhappy, manipulative, and deceitful. The students who showed the biggest decrease in immune response in the first study happened to be the same ones who wrote the negative stories in the follow-up. The implication is powerful. Ingrained ideas we carry around inside us wind up defining what relationships are all about, even when those ideas aren't aligned with the truth. they forcefully impose their own interpretation instead. Going back to Patrick, he and Fran had entered the first phase of romantic love, which is infatuation. In that state, everything about love is so powerful that reality changes.